and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, June 12th through Saturday the 14th feature conductor Riccardo Muti returning to direct a program including two trumpet concertos, one by Telemann, another by Michael Haydn, and both played by principal trumpet Esteban Batallan, and Haydn's Symphony No. 48, as well as the Schubert Fourth Symphony. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on the Haydn 48th Symphony, the one known as the Maria Theresa. The work lasts about 27 minutes. In Austria, we can still see a likeness of the Empress Maria Theresa on large silver coins. Today, they are collector's items, although during her lifetime, the coins were everyday currency. She appears somewhat overweight, the result perhaps of having 16 children by her vigorous husband, Emperor Franz I, and she has the haughty bearing of someone accustomed to wealth and entitlement since childhood. She was apparently so charming, however, that when the 6-year-old Mozart visited the palace in 1762, he climbed into her capacious lap and gave her a kiss. Joseph Haydn and the Empress met under more dignified circumstances. On September 1, 1773, Maria Theresa visited Esterhazy, the magnificent country estate of Haydn's employer, Prince Nicholas Esterhazy. That evening, after a performance of the Haydn opera L'Infedeltà delusa, the Empress was taken to the prince's fanciful new Chinese pavilion on the palace grounds, where she found the composer and his orchestra attired in Chinese costumes, waiting to give a concert. The following day, she was treated to 3 hazel hens, European grouse that Haydn had shot in her honor, which she evidently ate with enthusiasm, and to Haydn's marionette opera Philemon and Baucis, which so delighted her that 4 years later she invited the puppet troupe to Schönbrunn. Prince Nicholas introduced his Kapellmeister to the Empress, and before he left, she gave Haydn a valuable gold snuffbox filled with coins. This brilliant C major symphony is apparently the one Haydn and his orchestra played for the Empress in the mirrored splendor of the Chinese pavilion. The years surrounding Maria Theresa's visit were the most productive of Haydn's life. His output in symphony, string quartet, piano sonata, mass, and opera is not only enormous, but of an astonishing and consistently high level. During these years, Haydn wrote several symphonies in C major with high horn parts. With their bright sound and nervous energy, they are among the glories of the Haydn literature. The C major symphony we know as No. 48 was written in 1769. Haydn either saved it or decided to revive it for the Empress's visit 4 years later. It was an ideal choice because it is filled with a sense of occasion and from the opening measure with music of great pomp and festivity. The first movement, with its wildly reeling horn parts, is a fanfare enlarged to full sonata-form proportions, including a wealth of melodies and encompassing an unusually far-ranging key scheme. The slow movement, with oboe and horn solos, is a gentle interlude. The tone is one of restraint and courtly courtesy. The minuet is music of ceremony rather than dance. A trio in C minor briefly darkens the mood. "Let there be spectacles" is the most famous line attributed to Maria Theresa. If so, she surely loved the sensational high-energy finale of the Haydn Symphony that would later bear her name. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Maria Theresa, Haydn's Symphony No. 48. And now on to the Schubert Symphony No. 4, a work lasting about 28 minutes. Schubert's contemporaries, even the few who understood the magnitude of his talent, did not think of him as a composer of symphonies. Antonio Salieri, who was one of his first teachers and a man who knew the Viennese music scene as well as anyone in the early years of the 19th century, called Schubert a genius and said that he can write anything, songs, masses, string quartets, but he failed even to mention the symphony. Not one of the 8 symphonies by Schubert that Riccardo Muti and the Chicago Symphony performed this season was publicly known during the composer's lifetime. Most of them weren't even published until the very end of the 19th century, more than 50 years after Schubert's death. In 1894, while Antonín Dvořák was living in the United States, he wrote an article for the Century Illustrated Monthly magazine considering the reasons Schubert made his way so slowly to popular appreciation and why the symphonies in particular did not gain the immediate admiration of those by other composers. He was young, modest, and unknown, Dvořák writes, and musicians did not hesitate to slight a symphony which they would have felt bound to study had it borne the name of Beethoven or Mozart. The comparison with Beethoven is both inevitable and misleading. Schubert and Beethoven were composing symphonies at the same time in Vienna during the first years of the 19th century, never once meeting nor even crossing paths until the very end of Beethoven's life. Each of Beethoven's symphonies was premiered to considerable fanfare in one of Vienna's main public theaters within a year or so of its completion. Schubert's were privately performed in the same city and quickly forgotten. All nine of Beethoven's symphonies were published during his lifetime. Not one piece of Schubert's orchestral music appeared in print during his. And yet, for all his apparent lack of public success with the form, Schubert persisted. He started more symphonies than Beethoven and finished nearly as many, all in a shorter period of time. While Beethoven composed his nine over the span of 25 years, Schubert completed seven and left another six unfinished in just 17 years. Schubert was working on his newest one, the so-called Symphony No. 10, at the time of his death. In 1995, the Chicago Symphony performed Luciano Berio's haunting and imaginative rendering, which is based on Schubert's sketches for this symphony. For Dvořák, writing in 1894, Schubert's first six symphonies were recent discoveries, as they were for all musicians in the late 19th century. They were published for the first time in 1884 and 1885. He had recently begun to conduct the symphonies, and he highly recommended them to others. "The more I study them," Dvořák concluded, "the more I marvel." Written in little more than 4 years, from sometime in 1813 to February 1818, they are among the most impressive and substantial of Schubert's so-called early works, although, as Donald Tovey pointed out long ago, every work Schubert left us is an early work. They are so refined and assured that it is difficult to remember that they are the works of a teenage boy. Schubert's early symphonies come from the busiest time of his life. In 1815, 1816, the years in which he wrote the third and fourth symphonies that are performed this week, they were particularly productive years. He was still a schoolmaster then, a prisoner of the classroom who filled his free time writing the music that would one day make him famous. Schubert's off hours produced an extraordinary harvest. In 1815 alone, he composed two piano sonatas, a set of variations on an original theme, dances for keyboard, a string quartet, two masses, and considerable miscellaneous choral works, four operas, including Claudina von Villabella, which lost its second and third acts when the servants of Schubert's friend, Josef Hirtenbrenner, used the manuscript to start fires during the cold winter of 1848, and also some 145 songs, including the Erlkönig, long considered his greatest, and the D major symphony, now known as Number 3. Not all this music is important or memorable. Schubert must have been writing at breakneck speed and often well into the night, but much of it is unusually impressive regardless of the circumstances, and some of the songs in particular are among his finest works. They reveal a gift too strong and an imagination too vivid to be stifled even by the dull rigor of drilling reluctant boys. Schubert's manuscript tells us he began his third symphony on May 24th, the same day he wrote a piece for female chorus and horns. He had finished a one-act Singspiel 5 days earlier. In the next few days, he wrote several more choral works and a number of songs. He completed the Adagio Maestoso introduction and the first few pages of the Allegro of the symphony, and then put the score aside. He returned to the Allegro on July 11th. The entire symphony was completed 8 days later. Historians relish the tales of the occasional piece of music written at astonishing speed, but Schubert regularly did his best work in great haste. He once jotted down a song fully formed on the back of a cafe menu. Schubert knew the orchestra from the inside. He began playing in the student ensemble of Vienna's Imperial and Royal City College at the age of 12, and we might well guess from listening to his Symphony No. 3 that as an orchestral musician, he regularly played symphonies by Haydn and Mozart, as well as the first two by Beethoven. Yet, for all his grounding in the great classical school, Schubert early on revealed a distinctive way with traditional forms. Any composer capable of writing one of the most extraordinary songs in the literature, Gretchen am Spinnrade, at the age of 17, had quickly found his own voice. By the time he wrote that song in 1814, Schubert had finished his first symphony, and by the time he completed his third, less than a year later, Schubert had written what many composers would gladly claim as a life's work, and he had traveled light years in the perfection of his own style. Schubert's Symphony No. 4 is his first in a minor key. He begins with an impressive, probing, slow introduction that recalls the celebrated beginning of Haydn's The Creation in its seriousness, weight, and musical daring. In the first 10 measures, Haydn travels from C minor to G flat major, the other side of the harmonic globe. The following allegro music is scarcely less adventuresome, although it eventually moves decisively toward C major and stays there till the end of the movement. Whereas Mozart or Beethoven tended to save the arrival of the major key for the very end of the piece as a kind of dramatic grand conclusion. The two middle movements are both in major keys, A-flat for the expansive and deeply expressive andante, E-flat for the minuet. C minor returns for the finale. The eventual transformation into C major is not so much a hard-won victory as in Beethoven's Fifth, composed just 8 years earlier, but the kind of shift that comes naturally to a composer whose musical language is characterized by the subtle, sometimes heartbreaking interplay of shadow and light. Schubert added the tragic subtitle to the manuscript later on as an afterthought, perhaps to call attention to the fact that this symphony stands apart from his other orchestral works. It is the only symphony to which he gave a name. In mid-1816, shortly after he finished the tragic symphony, Schubert began to keep a diary. The earliest entries mention Beethoven, Goethe, and Schiller, the magic notes of Mozart's music, the pleasures of a walk in the country on a hot summer's evening, and a party honoring Salieri. But there's only one passing reference to writing music. Today, I composed for money for the first time. No doubt, writing music was so commonplace for the young composer that it didn't merit comment. But Schubert did call attention to the remarkable fact that for once, he was paid for what he did every day with consistency and brilliance that seldom accompanies such profusion. Generous remuneration, however, was not steady in Schubert's life. And when he died only 12 years later at 31, music's youngest tragic loss, he had little more than clothes, bed linens, a few dog-eared books, and a pile of manuscripts to leave behind. Program notes by Philip Pusher on Schubert's Symphony No. 4. I'm Richard Caparella. Thanks for listening.